Thank you, everybody, for joining me here today for the ribbon-cutting ceremony for the Kion Wolf Center for the Performing Arts. This building is the culmination of a dream. In that dream, I was performing Shakespeare's Twelfth Night for an audience of giant ladybugs, and I was not wearing any pants. Before we cut the ribbon, please let your eyes wander across the fabulous architecture of the Wolf Center, a design by Gary Associates. Not, unfortunately, Frank Gehry. Our budget did not allow that. This is by his second cousin, Marty Gehry, an honors graduate of the Acme Online School of Architecture in Belize City. And look at that, just on time, the first snowflake of the day fluttering down from the heavens. Okay, maybe we cut too many corners. Speaking of cut, should I still cut this ribbon, or... No? Just back away from the rubble? Okay, today's show tells the story of Connecticut's most famous roof collapse and the lessons it taught us. And now he bought the last two concession stand hot dogs at the old Civic Center, Colin McEnroe.
Thanks for that. Yes, it was January 18th, 1978, very, very early in the morning, 4:15 a.m. in the morning, I think by most accounts. It was a roof. If you can just try to imagine what an acre of land is, this is a 2.4-acre roof collapse. There was no one in the building, thank God. No one was hurt. No one died. And as a result, it turned into a series of lawsuits and engineering questions, as opposed to being the worst tragedy in American history, which is probably what it would have been if the arena had been filled to capacity with people and this had fallen in. So it was both a lucky and very unlucky thing. Today on the show, we're going to talk about that particular event, and we're also going to spend a little bit of time talking about roof design in general. And, I mean, obviously, this is not the only roof that ever has collapsed under the weight of snow and other design problems, and it wasn't the first. It won't be the last. We've had a bunch of them here in Connecticut in recent years with heavy snowfalls. So we'll also talk a little bit about why, after all these thousands of years of human civilization, we can't build roofs that don't collapse. I mean, most of them don't collapse, obviously. But anyway, we'll come to that. As we go along here, also, if you have recollections of that time and things that it stirred up in you, 860-275-7266. Or if you have questions, 860-275-7266. Most of the work on the show today is going to be done by Howard Epstein, a professor in the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering at the University of Connecticut, a registered professional structural engineer, and George Torello, a forensic structural engineer and principal of Torello Engineers in Essex, Connecticut. You'll meet both of them in just a second here, and they're going to be telling us the story of the problems with the Civic Center roof, what was learned, what wasn't learned, to what degree a consensus was ever reached about why the roof fell in and how to avoid things like that in the future. They'll also talk to us a little bit, as I said, about other occasions in which things have fallen down that weren't supposed to, including roofs under the weight of snow. All of that is to come, but we thought we would begin, since we're talking about this today, we thought we would begin with some of the people who first laid eyes on this. I was a reporter at the Hartford Courant at the time. This was the biggest story at the Hartford Courant in years, so I was not assigned to it. They had their best people work on it instead. We have two of them here right now. Joining us is Mike Regan. He was the reporter for the Hartford Courant, one of the reporters for the Courant who covered the collapse of the roof. I think he was the chief City Hall reporter at the time. I may be wrong. Carol Giacomo was another reporter for the Hartford Courant who covered that collapse, currently working for the New York Times editorial board. They're both with us today. And Carol, we're going to find out how your cell phone's working right now. You kind of got the first call. You were the first person, at least for the Hartford Courant, on the scene. Is that correct?
Yes, I was. That's true.
And just recreate this for us. So you got a call from somebody, right, telling you to go as quickly as you could to the Civic Center.
Right, exactly. And I think it was the first time in my journalistic career when I was awakened in the middle of the night and told to get to the scene of a crisis immediately. And I lived on Zion Street, so I was pretty close to the action, and I got there within 15 minutes of the call. And I had covered a lot. At the time, the Hartford Civic Center was really a sort of a central anchor to the rebirth of Hartford. It was an exciting time. There were people in politics. There were people in government and in business who really were investing a lot in the city and trying to make it revive. And the Civic Center was so critical to all of that. And to get to arrive on the scene and see the building, which was, a reasonably new structure, suddenly fallen in on itself and looking like, you know, an erector set that somebody had pushed over was pretty shocking, I must say.
Yeah, and as we go along later in the show, we will talk to our engineers about why it looked the way that it did. Obviously, there was a big thing that we came to call a space frame that was sagging in the middle of there. And then, yeah, there were this kind of these erector set-like things sticking up, and they'll be able to explain all of that to us. Mike Regan, you were among the other first reporters on the scene. First of all, what are your memories? By the time you and Carol got there, I'm assuming things were kind of cordoned off and there were emergency workers. I mean, were the streets deserted or was the whole area kind of secured at that point?
There were emergency workers all around, but I was kind of surprised. Looking back from today, I'm kind of surprised at the amount of access we had. I probably got there. I got the phone call about the same time Carol did, I guess, from Charlie Morris, who was the city editor at the time. And I remember getting there and walking up Church Street, and you could see emergency crews and emergency and flashing lights, but I walked right up to the building, and the first thing I saw that sort of struck me as a sign that something was out of the ordinary were these big chunks of pink insulation that had been blown out of the sides of the building by the force of the collapse. And it wasn't really until I got up to the top of the Sheraton Hotel, it's a Hilton now, I guess, up to the top of the Sheraton Hotel and looked down at it from 20 feet up that I really understood the magnitude of the disaster. I mean, it really sort of turned your stomach to think what might have happened had there been people in that building.
Yeah, the Sheraton was where you went to look at it, and another of our former colleagues, Henry McNulty, this week told me the story of many days later, because it sat there like that for a really long time. I think they weren't even sure exactly how to begin clearing the rubble, how to begin securing, I mean, even beginning the work of removal and then repair. But so it sat like that for a long time, and so the ABC sportscaster, Jim McKay, was for some reason visiting Hartford, and Henry was assigned to interview him, and he took him up to the top floor of the Sheraton, and Jim McKay looked out the window, and he said what pretty much everybody said, which was, "Holy bleep!" And Henry says he'll you know, most people remember Jim McKay for the thrill of victory and the agony of defeat. He'll just remember Jim McKay for "Holy bleep!" because that was kind of what everybody said. It really, Carol, I don't know if you got up to see the overhead thing that morning when you got there, but it really, when you saw it, there wasn't. It kind of robbed you of your ability to say anything. It was so shocking.
Yeah, I agree. I did not go up high. I was on the ground that day talking to emergency workers and public officials, but I saw pictures, so yeah, it was dramatic.
Did you know, did everybody know right away that everybody was okay? Did it take a while to be sure? Oh, yeah, go ahead.
No. I mean, and that was the first question you asked, was anybody inside? And it seemed to me like they were able to determined pretty quickly that there wasn't anybody inside, and thank goodness, because hours earlier there were thousands of people there.
Yes, hours earlier there was a UConn basketball game, and there were, in fact, thousands of people there. Mike Regan, one of the next things that you had to cover, I think, was a press conference or a series of press conferences. You were a City Hall reporter at the time. Talk about sort of the political ripples over this. How did it get processed by city leadership?
Well, I mean, city leadership really reacted overall pretty impressively, especially if you compare it to sort of the dysfunction that occasionally has struck the city in more recent years. But, you know, by the end of the first day, the city manager announced that the Coliseum would be rebuilt. They had launched parallel investigations, one by a city council committee and the other by a team of forensic engineers out of New York into exactly what had happened. And I think there was a big effort to try to maintain whatever momentum in terms of the Hartford rebirth that the Civic Center generated. But you know, there was inevitably political sniping between various figures in City Hall, primarily the mayor, George Atherton, and the city council majority leader, Nick Carbone. And that, I think, kind of colored what happened in the subsequent months.
You know, my recollection at the time, first of all, to kind of help people understand, the city was governed a little bit differently back in those days. The mayor did not have a lot of power. It was not a strong mayor system. And Nick Carbone, who was the leader of the city council, really was the guy who had the most power, the most say over what happened in the city. Behind him also was a non-governmental group of people informally known as the bishops. And these were these heads of companies who made a lot of the decisions and influenced a lot of the things that happened. And I think they'd put a lot of their weight and emphasis on the Civic Center, and Nick Carbone had. And Carol Giacomo, I mean, I think for Hartford for a while, one of the questions was how well known are we going to be for this? You know, to how long is it going to take us to get out from under this persistent image? This is, you know, they didn't want, in my recollection, they were very eager not to have this be what Hartford was known for.
Right, exactly, and that goes to the political response, and why I think it was the city manager Dakin who, within hours, said, you know, we're going to build it bigger and better, and they did, you know, take this on with a lot of energy, and as much as at the time one might be suspicious of the bishops, and you know, not always sure exactly where their hand was being felt in the things that happened in Hartford. The fact that they were able to be, you know, behind the effort to rebuild was very significant. And I would also make one other point. The paper at the time the Hartford Courant was a pretty strong paper, and there was a lot of attention given to the rebuilding. And I remember personally, I mean, I was no expert in construction by any means, but we really covered the rebuilding of the building with incredible detail. I mean, there were, you know, questions about exactly what kind of trusses would be used in the new roof. If there were questions about which kind of bolt would be used, you know, we'd do a whole story on that. It seemed to be dancing on the head of a pin, but given the kind of tragedy that happened with the Civic Center, you couldn't be too careful.
Yeah, Mike Regan, I have similar memories of all you guys trying to master this material, and of the average citizen, too, who had probably never heard a phrase like space frame or space truss before. Suddenly, the average citizen was trying to figure out, how could this have possibly happened? And, you know, what's the technology? What's the engineering behind it? I don't know. What are your recollections of that?
I mean, one thing that I recall is that, along with the investigations, the city really made an effort to appear transparent. They emptied out a couple of rooms, I think on the third floor of City Hall, and just filled them with every public document that had to do with the design and construction of the Civic Center. You know, everything from sprinkler permits to the most complicated computer-generated designs. But you know, one of the things that there was so much information, it was really kind of impossible to digest it all. One of the things that came out was that there was really no one who had overall charge of the thing. One company did the design, one did the construction, and nobody really felt the imperative to make sure that all the parts of this thing were working together.
We're going to spend the next section talking about that. I want to thank Mike Regan and Carol Giacomo. I think he's probably Michael Regan officially, but he's Mike to me, for joining us here today. We're going to take a little break, and as I say, we welcome your calls and your questions. We're going to turn things over to the engineers in the next segment. Thanks to the reporters, and we'll be back after this.
This way again, you can rest assured. I'll always do my best for her, on that I give my word. In a world of steel eyed death and men who are fighting to be warm, come in, she said, I'll give ya shelter from the storm.
All right, we're back. We're talking about the collapse of the Hartford Civic Center roof, and we will proceed outward from there eventually to talk about other roofs, too. We welcome your phone calls at 860-275-7266, 860-275-7266. We're turning things over to the engineers here. Howard Epstein is a professor in the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering at the University of Connecticut and a registered professional structural engineer. George Torello is a forensic structural engineer and principal of Torello Engineers. Howard Epstein, first of all, tell us, what was your role in the aftermath of the collapse of the roof?
One of my colleagues was contacted by Mayor Atkinson, and later realized that this was all political. The mayor wanted some say in what was going on, and he formed an academic task force, it was called, and there were a couple of people from UConn, from Yale, from University of Hartford. And we weren't given very much access to anything, except we were I did get about 4 days later to go into the site and walk around. That was one of the scariest things to witness, seeing all that steel and the seats and what might have been. But we met with the mayor and testified once before the city council, and that was about our investigation, except a colleague of mine, we together did some extensive computer analysis and sort of wrote what I think is a definitive paper on what happened.
And I have that paper here, and you can see Howard with his 1980s hair. There's a picture of him down at the bottom. Very different haircut than he wears today. I just saw American Hustle, so I'm very attuned to hair from that era. All right, so George Torello, there were investigations, there were hearings, there was every possible effort was made to understand what did happen to that building. Is it now a settled matter? Does everybody agree on why that roof fell in, or are there still divergent theories?
There are many theories still not answered. What our role was is to go through the wreckage, look at the welds, and do some ultrasonic and radiographic testing, a lot of visual inspections, to discover if the welds were up to par. Did they meet the code? Were they up to industry practice or not? We spent many, many hours with the final determination was that none of the welds were in agreement with the American Welding Society code at the time, and they were very, very small welds and did not agree with what the design drawings called for.
You know, Howard, when we look at something like this, it seems to me we sort of look at two sets of questions. One set is purely technical questions, questions like the one that George is just bringing up right now. Were the welds up to code? Did they conform with what they were supposed to be? And there are a lot of questions like this. And then there's a whole other set of questions, which is once we've established that certain kinds of technical mistakes were made and things weren't right, things weren't done correctly, how is that possible in a project of this size? So we're probably going to have to look at both of those things as the three of us talk about this. By the way, we have some interesting calls coming in from Catherine of Tallinn and Dave from Glastonbury. Hang on the line here. But so, Howard, let's go back to your definitive paper on this, the one that you wrote with a colleague. I mean, what did you definitively ultimately wind up saying about this?
I think probably the people who were hired by the city of Hartford, that was Lev Zetlin and company and Charlie Thornton, within several days, they had a press conference and said within the next 60 days, I think, we will tell you and have a conference tell you what happened, which means that they knew right away what happened. It was not a big problem to figure out that there was a major design error. And they knew about it probably within days of seeing the drawings and looking at what the collapse was all about.
When we see design error, I just want to stop you there so we can explore this a little bit. So this was what was called a space truss or a space frame. And one of the things that was said retroactively about it was that part of the reason for the design was that you could save money. You could build something like this less expensively. I don't know if that's something said with the benefit of hindsight. Seems like the kind of thing that might be. But was that the case?
No, it wasn't because of the economics of this, although it was a very interesting structure at the time. It was built completely on the ground, lifted up, jacked up to its final position, which was a money-saving operation because then you could build the stadium underneath it. So there were some problems with that because it was supposed to be painted on the ground, and they wound up having a painter's strike, and it was painted up in the air. So it didn't exactly work out that way. But this was a space truss, it was called at the time, and still is. And the technology for computer analysis was sort of in its infancy. Since then, we are able to do a little bit better as far as the analysis is concerned. But also, as a result of this collapse, and we can talk about this later, there were some laws passed in the state, and now any structure major like this needs an independent structural review. The main problem with this structure and with a lot of things that fall down are the connections. It's usually not the sizes of the piece themselves. It's how they're joined together. And one little change by the fabricators, Bethlehem Steel, of how to connect these pieces, the bracing pieces in particular, what did in the structure.
I'll go to Dave's call right now. This is Dave calling from Glastonbury. Hi, Dave.
Hey, how are you doing, Colin?
Just fine.
I've been waiting for years for the opportunity to say this. My business was hired to paint the windows around the Civic Center to hide the vacancy and the stuff going on to make it look pretty. And we worked late at night, and a lot of the electricians and plumbers, et cetera, the feet on the ground, at 2 and 3 in the morning when we were drinking coffee and working our butts off, said they would never take their families in there. They knew it was going to collapse. And when it did collapse, I remember walking behind everybody with the white hats on and hearing them with their pencils and talking, geez, we don't know. Well, how come they didn't know? The normal people who worked there, including me and my crew, all knew it was going to come down. And it could have killed 10,000 people.
It could have. It would have been the biggest tragedy in American history. Well, George Torello, I'm going to ask you about that in a more general way, which is that I heard similar stories. That we had a photographer at the Current named Mo Murray who used to go out to some bar that a lot of the construction workers were at. And he told me the same thing, that construction workers that he talked to said they would never take their kids in there, they would never go in there, that they knew from things that they'd seen over the course of building the Hartford Civic Center that there was something wrong, something that was, in their experience anyway, wrong enough to scare them, to make them unlikely to go in. Mo, of course, told us all this after the Hartford Civic Center roof fell in, not before. But is that just sort of something that happens after anything like this, that suddenly everybody now has a story about how they knew or somebody told them? Or is there some legitimacy to these accounts from workers?
Well, as they were raising the space truss, space frame up into the air, there were certain members that were unstable. And they began to bow laterally just a little bit.
When you say member, what is that? That's an engineering term that people may not. What's a member?
Well, a member is, in this case, was a 30-foot long quadruple angle in a cruciform shape. And those were the compression members, both in the cords and in the web members of the truss. And the ones that were not connected properly began to allow the major truss members to bow laterally. And as the, especially the ones at the perimeter of the structure, and as they raised it up, the perimeter members bowed so badly that the subcontractors trying to put the facade on couldn't make it fit. It was bowed too much, and so they added some cables and to try to put that back into with turnbuckles, and they tried to straighten it out so they could actually get the facade up.
That I don't know anything about engineering or construction, but that sounded scary just the way that you said it. And Howard, this is something that came up again and again, right? The Philadelphia Inquirer reported about this, that the construction workers had said that they'd seen things that alarmed them. And one got the sense, just reading the analysis, reading a lot of the articles that were written afterwards, that there were things that you could kind of eyeball and see, or that construction workers knew, right, that weren't right, that had to do with, to use your term from earlier, connections?
Well, yes, and there were certain signs, but I don't think anybody could have said that I'm not going to bring my kids in there because I know this is going to collapse. This was an unusual structure. It was very large, 300 feet by 360 feet, and that deflects an awful lot, and it should. I mean, things need under their own weight just to show some signs of this. But the facade might have been a warning sign. It was bowed out, and really, if people looked at that a little bit closer at the time, would have realized that there was something wrong with that. Once again, would that have done in the structure? No, it was more the details of all the inner pieces. This is a very highly redundant structure. You can take out hundreds of pieces, and it still should have enough capacity to hold the snow that night and a heck of a lot more snow.
Well, so one of the theories that was put forward, I think it was put forward by Lev Zetlin Associates, had to do with the design, that the design somehow or other failed to adequately calculate what the actual load was. I tried to get up to speed on this as much as I could, but there's sort of something called a dead load and a snow load, right?
Yes. Well, the original design engineers missed the dead load. That's the weight of the structure itself. They missed it by about 20%, which shouldn't happen, but that didn't do in the structure. Mm-hmm. There's all sorts of mistakes that were made. There's mistakes made in almost any construction project. And that led eventually to all the different suits and who eventually paid for this collapse. But it was the details of the way in which these 30-foot-long pieces that are in compression and are subjected to buckling were held at the middle improperly, just because of the ease in which the fabricators found. But nobody ever looked at that or considered that as a possibility.
Let me grab a call here from Catherine and Tallinn. Our number again, 860-275-7266. 860-275-7266. What's on your mind, Catherine?
Oh, hi. I just wanted to say I was working for American Airlines, the old Corvette building,
yep,
which you all might know, on the 9th floor. And our break area was a bird's eye view of the collapse of the Civic Center.
Mm-hmm.
So we saw it every day from the beginning to the end of the construction. And it really was, like a lot of your commentators are saying, it was an amazing thing. I mean, it really did make you think, oh, my gosh, how lucky at 415. But my question was, it was just the arena that was impacted, because I think the stores were still open. Well, not open, but they weren't affected by the crash.
I think, but my recollection is that's correct, too, that in a way this thing kind of contained itself, right?
That's true. That's true.
Yeah.
It's just the arena itself. They stores were still in operation while they were doing the reconstruction.
Now, one thing we've said over and over again, and you just heard it said again, is, yes, we were so lucky that it was at 4:15 in the morning. There was nobody in there. There had been a lot of people in there 6 or 7 hours before that. Is it significant? I've understood from some of the reading and some of the work that the producers for the show have done that one theory is it may actually have been less likely to fall in when there were a lot of people in it.
That's the very interesting part of this, and thank goodness. About 11 o'clock at night, the last people were out of the building. And there was very little additional snow between 11 o'clock at night and 4:30 in the morning. And we were wondering why did it fall in when it did. At the time, we had some students go up to the Springfield Civic Center and monitor the inside of the building versus the outside for the pressure differential due to the people inside and the heat that they were generating. And the people inside the building, with the heat they were generating, was enough to keep that roof up until it cooled down and was evacuated. Otherwise, there would have been 5,000 deaths.
Mm-hmm. That's amazing. That's the first time I've ever heard that. That's an amazing thing, amazing idea. Our number again, 860-275-7266. George Torella, one of the feelings I'm getting from you and from Howard is that what happens, I guess, when there's a disaster like this is every single piece of the building, every single thing that can be looked at gets looked at. And as Howard said before, all kinds of mistakes get made in the building of all kinds of buildings. So when you find a building that's fallen down or when something seriously wrong has happened with the building, you're going to find lots of mistakes, but they won't all be the mistakes that caused the collapse, right?
Yes.
So how do you figure out which one did cause the collapse?
Well, what happened is the attorneys that hired us for the insurance companies asked the question, when that last snowflake fell at 4:15 in the morning, where was the weak link? Was it a faulty bolt? Was it a weld that cracked? Exactly what happened when that last snowflake fell? And we spent months going through the wreckage, so to speak, where all the connections were stored in a warehouse. We went through the welds, the groove welds, and we radiographed and ultrasonically checked them just the way they were supposed to be checked in the fabricating shop years before. And we found out that all of the welds that were radiographed originally, they were very good. They were right up to standard, right up to the code, and they were almost perfect. But all of the fillet welds that had only visual examinations by a testing laboratory who actually falsified the records and said that all the welds were satisfactory. In actual fact, only 2% of the welds were anything like what was called for on the drawing. So we had a structure that was full of faulty welds and just waiting for something to happen. One of the theories that we looked at was the scoreboard theory, where we knew for a fact that when they welded the scoreboard structures, there's two big 24-inch deep beams that held the scoreboard up to the underside of the space frame. Three of the welds at the ends of the 24-inch deep girders were okay. They were 3/8-inch thick, but the last one was only a tiny little, like a 3/16 tiny weld, where it appeared that the welder went out to lunch and never came back or went away at the end of the day. And the theory is that as the bottom surface of the space frame curved downward under the weight of the snow, this one tiny little weld popped. The scoreboard members rotated and opened up one of the panel points in the actual structure. And whether or not that was the triggering element, it certainly looked to us like it may have been.
Howard Epstein, who did wind up? I mean, was there sort of, there was a final judgment? There was somebody's insurance company paid out on this. I mean, how did this all get kind of resolved?
My understanding was there was eventually a settlement, and the people who paid the most money were the ones who had the deepest pockets. And that was Bethlehem Steel, the erectors. Did they make some mistakes? Sure, everybody makes some mistakes, but did that lead to the collapse? No. And as a result of that, I think they paid $10 million. As a result of that, Bethlehem Steel no longer was in the business of erecting structures.
You teach engineering. So, I mean, obviously one of the questions is what gets learned from something like this? You've got a situation where a lot of different mistakes were made for a lot of different reasons, and it would be pretty easy to prevent anybody from building a 2.4-acre space truss exactly that way ever again. That part's easy. What ultimately did the world of engineering learn so that it could teach students, could teach future engineers not to make these mistakes, or construction crews or contractors or whoever needed to learn these lessons?
Well, one major lesson that was learned was what are called bracing elements, and this is not the main part of the structure, but it was integral in the fact that these pieces should not have bowed, and you don't put in eccentricity into connections. Although I see this again and again, and it still is out there. I've seen some Ferris wheels that I've investigated that have the same mistakes that are made in them, and you wonder, you know, when this lesson is going to be learned. But one interesting thing that did come out of this, there was a piece in the stored in a warehouse, and let me say it had almost nothing to do with the collapse, but I had never seen a piece fail like this. This Civic Center roof falling down became one of the largest laboratories, structural engineer of failures and how ductile steel members are. But this led to a 10 years worth of my research into what are called tension connections and how they could fail that was never seen in the textbooks before. And now I got a little footnote in textbooks about looking out for this kind of failure.
Obviously, those are technical and technological and engineering failures. There's another kind of failure, obviously, that seems to have to do with inspection. And my recollection was that one of the things that came out over the course of the investigation was that typically there might be an independent inspector of this kind of stuff, and that this project departed from that a little bit. Is that true?
Well, at the time, there was no such thing as independent structural review. That has come into play as a result of that collapse, the L'Ambiance Plaza, Miana's River Bridge, all sorts of other things that were there at the time. So any major structure is supposed to have an independent structural engineer look at it. Whether or not that would have caught it, let me just say one thing, because the city of Hartford did a review of this structure. Mm-hmm. They had their engineering staff look at that. This sort of overwhelmed them, so they farmed out things that they were good at, like school buildings, because this was a sexy structure to be looking at. They had no idea what a space truss was all about. So the city of Hartford was partially responsible for this, and they suffered a lot of damage as a result.
Absolutely. You know, George Dorello, Howard just mentioned Miana's River Bridge, L'Ambiance Plaza. You know, we went through a stretch here in Connecticut in the 70s, late 70s and 80s, where we had those three in particular disasters. I think Lev Zetlin was called in on all three of them, too. I think the Lev Zetlin Associates, they became kind of like a little household name around here in Connecticut. Did we have more than our fair share? Was that just sort of luck of the draw? Was Connecticut, I don't know, I mean, was that atypical for a state of Connecticut size and population to have three such big engineering disasters?
Well, as Howard mentioned, there was no independent structural analysis made, and it was all up to whatever one engineer came up with in the design. Mm-hmm. There was no one to look over his shoulder and look at it another way. Today, whenever a building is more than 60 feet high or 300 foot wide, such as the space frame was, so larger structures have to have an independent structural engineer review. And also, there are, which began in the 1989 building code, special inspections, which are, for the most part, beyond the capability of the building officials. The building officials and the building inspectors from each and every town in Connecticut, 169 of them. So the special inspections are done by certified welding inspectors and concrete inspectors on the concrete work, and all of those reports are turned into the building department.
I'm never going on a Ferris wheel again until Howard Epstein says it's okay to do that. But do you feel in general now in 2014 that things in Connecticut are a lot safer than they were, say, 30 years ago?
Well, a lot of the major buildings that were more recently built, yes, but there are still many, many flaws in large buildings, and this was proven during the storm Irene, when hundreds of roofs collapsed and shouldn't have. And both our office and other engineering firms found the same kind of thing. When a roof collapsed under snow that was only maybe one-third the weight that it should have been. In other words, no roof should ever collapse with 30 pounds of snow per square foot. Mm-hmm. That's typically the minimum amount of snow that buildings in Connecticut are designed and built for. But these buildings should never collapse until you've had like 60, 70, 80 pounds per square foot. Looking back, we see that there were already flaws in these buildings that did have the roofs cave in. There was some kind of a flaw already there, whether it was from corrosion, from lack of bolting or lack of bracing or whatever. The state of Connecticut compiled lists from that they gleaned from each and every building department in the state. And many of these buildings were unoccupied. They were neglected. And as I say, there are many, many roofs today that exist that no one's really looked at very carefully. And they will fall. They will cave in. The roofs will collapse as we have the snow, the weight of the snow on those roofs.
All right. That's going to set us up very well for the final segment of our show. Very quickly here, I just want to grab Bill's call so we just don't lose him. Then we're going to take a break. We'll come back for the final segment. Be less about the Hartford Civic Center and more about, as George is saying, roofs in general. Here's Bill from North Haven with a question. Hi.
Yeah, he just answered a lot of my questions, like, you know, quality control, guys inspecting the, you know, the stress for concrete and stuff like that. You know, and I worked at a supply house years and years ago, and there was a lot of stuff that came in that was really substandard, and it was going into power plants and stuff, and it was stuff that wasn't really supposed to have been there. It was made in China, and it was supposed to have been,
speaking of substandard,
where at the time they had really good quality.
Bill, are you talking on a?
Now their quality is fantastic.
But Bill, we're losing some of you because your phone is breaking up. Are you on a cordless phone that's away from its base unit or something like that?
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, much better, much better. So yeah, finish up.
I don't know
there.
If you heard what I said about quality control. Yeah. That was the main thing. You know, like the quality of steel. Make sure it's, you know, it's getting it from, you know, reputable places, the stress, you know what I mean?
Exactly.
Stuff like that. That's basically what I had, quality control. That has a lot to do with stuff, you know?
Absolutely. Thanks for your call. I'm going to take one more call here, then we'll go to break. We'll come back for our final segment here. This is Chris calling from Massachusetts. Hi, Chris.
Oh, hello. I'm a first-time caller, but been enjoying your conversation about the Civic Center and also, you know, generally snow-related roof collapses. Our company actually has a system. We help property owners, retail buildings and so forth, data centers, with roof load monitoring through deflection monitoring. And we had an interesting experience with one of our clients where we had a system installed and repeatedly one particular area experienced alarm or deflection, you know, when it shouldn't have. And on closer inspection, they found sure enough that there were some mechanical attachments that weren't correctly taken care of. The way the building was made was with something they call Z-purlins, and some of them weren't bolted together, so they weren't properly nested. And that, I guess, made the roof bend more, so we were able to find it with our alarm system.
So your alarm system basically tells somebody where the heavy load is in the roof and how the roof is reacting to the load?
Yeah, that's exactly what it does. It helps, you know, property managers with really big buildings when they have a lot to deal with. You know, gives them a way to direct their attention appropriately. Hmm. Gives people or data processing places that are really concerned about, you know, they just don't have the ability to absorb the risk. They just want to know. Gives them a tool to react to. And, you know, we work with engineers regularly.
Howard Epstein was nodding while you were talking. He may have something to say about that, but I got to take our break right now. We'll come back with a very short final segment after this.
I found a paradise that's trouble-free. And if this world starts getting you down, there's room enough for two upon the
My investigation into the Kion Wolf Center for the Performing Arts roof collapse has revealed that the design and materials all came from Etsy. See, I would trust them for certain craft supplies, but not so much for buildings. Today's show was produced by Betsy Kaplan and me. The part of Bill Curry was played by Diana Ross. For aerial video footage of the collapsed Civic Center roof provided by Jennifer Boyd of CPTV, and for other articles, photos, links, and gifts of the Faith Middleton Show staff knocking over a Lego model of the Mall of America, visit our website, WNPR.org. On tomorrow's show, our salute to twins. And now, back to Colin.
All right. No time to tell you about that show. I do also want to say tomorrow on Where We Live on The Wheelhouse, I'll be joining Mr. Dankosky. One of the things we will be talking about today was the sad news that Tom DeMoore, former Republican state chairman and the guy who engineered Lowell Weicker's third party victory as governor, has died today. He was a terrific guy, really interesting guy, and stood for a kind of politics we don't have that much anymore, the kind of politics that isn't so much about making enemies. Anyway, we'll be talking about that and other things tomorrow. Right now, we're talking to Howard Epstein and George Torello. They are both engineers. They are explaining to us things about roof collapses. We heard a call, Howard, from a guy whose company does put in these kind of alarm systems that can sort of say where the load is on the roof and where the, how the roof is reacting. Although, as you said, what if you had something like that at the Hartford Civic Center and the alarm went off? Would you evacuate 12,000 people in a big hurry? That could create a whole different set of problems.
It sure could. They do have ways of checking the deflection now, and George can talk to that.
Do you want to say anything about that? Yeah.
Yes, we can. In fact, we're actually monitoring some structures right now where we send a team in to check on deflections from time to time, especially during a heavy snowstorm.
And deflection is how the roof is reacting to the load, right?
It's how it's usually deflecting downward.
Yeah, bending down, basically.
And the people at the Hartford Civic Center, new one, wanted to do that, and they actually do that now in the new structure by having targets that are painted on the inside of the structure. And during a heavy snowstorm, the surveyors go in with laser equipment, and they can detect whether one part of the structure is deflecting more than it should.
Howard, Chris mentioned, I noticed you kind of nodding and jotting down stuff when Chris was mentioning one kind of roof.
Well, he mentioned Z-purlins, and those are famous or infamous on these so-called pre-engineered metal buildings that pop up. And those buildings are built right to the limit, and you got to be really careful and make sure all the elements in those are connected properly and people who know what they're doing put those together. Before we go, though, I think it'd be interesting for George, who was involved in some of the inspection on the reconstruction, to tell you that there were problems with that, too, that didn't necessarily get out there in the public.
Yeah, I always assumed it was probably the safest building to go into, given what had happened there before. We got about a minute left there, George.
People asked me about that, and I said, if the weight of the inspectors could be held, then it's going to be safe.
We got about a minute left there, George Torello. Yeah.
Okay, during the erection of the Civic Center as it is now, every single well was looked at by a CWI who has his own personal stamp on the well. The wells were checked and double-checked and ultrasonically checked, except when we came to the open-web steel joists. The city maintained, and they were correct, that open-web joists that were 83 feet long, spanning between the structural members, were not structural steel. They were manufactured items, and they required no inspection. But we sent a couple of letters to the city of Hartford, and we said we ought to at least have one inspection where they're hanging a speaker platform 8,000 pounds worth. So we got a man to go down to South Carolina where they were manufacturing the trusses, the open web steel joists, and sure enough, there were crack wells, there were tiny wells, there were missing wells. And that led to an inspection that lasted for 3 weeks, right around the clock, 24 hours a day, of checking out each and every well in the new Hartford Civic Center roof for the open web steel joists. The welders were in one bucket, the inspectors were in another. They found the flaws, they found the missing wells, and they corrected them right up until the last minute at 4:30 in the afternoon of the day when the Civic Center reopened with the Hartford Whalers. And 4:30 in the afternoon, the Department of Inspections for the city okayed the opening of the Civic Center.
Signed off on that final weld. We got to stop now. We thank so much to Howard Epstein and George Torello. I have a movie out, action movie called Roof, in which John Cusack will be playing George Torello, and Bradley Cooper will be playing Howard Epstein. It's an action movie. See it at your local theater. Stay tuned for their books, The Last Snowflake. We'll be back tomorrow.
That should do it. I'm proud to announce the Kion Wolf Center for the Performing Arts is now back. No, not Drizzle! I thought Sue Grew could fix anything.